democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI-FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, online and archived at kfai.org, the community's true voice.
Welcome to the Mini Culture Podcast. I'm your host, Erica Janik. Stillwater Prison started publishing its own newspaper in 1887. It's called the Prison Mirror. When it started, it was one of the country's first prison papers. And today, it's one of the last. Throughout its history, the Prison Mirror has given incarcerated writers a voice and national recognition, even book deals, journalism jobs, and pardons. As Stillwater Prison prepares to close, Michelle Brook talked to people inside and outside prison to learn about what it's like covering the news behind bars.
The first prison in Minnesota Territory opened right on Stillwater's Main Street in 1853. The guards enforced a very long list of rules.
No talking. The prison had a nickname. They called it the Silent City because the inmates were not allowed to speak to one another.
Heidi Hines directs a museum in the old house where the prison wardens lived. She explained that even in the mess hall, talking was forbidden. If you wanted bread, you'd hold up your right hand. More water, hold up your cup.
They weren't even allowed to make eye contact. Your eyes were to be downcast. Everybody had to march lockstep. They absolutely were beaten. Every guard is given a cane with a metal tip on it that they did use to beat inmates.
The Stillwater Prison relocated in 1914 to its present location, a couple miles south in Bayport. The warden's house where Heidi works is the last surviving building on the original site. People say it's haunted.
I'll leave things a certain way at night and go home and nobody's here. I come back in the morning and it's different. I've had weird audio things, and you should go back and listen to this and see if you can hear anything in the background. I've heard audio of me giving a tour where there's a ghost that finishes my sentences. If I pause, you can hear a voice.
I didn't hear anything.
And it's kind of hard to determine who is the ghost of the warden's house because there's a lot of candidates. Innumerable true tales of terror and tragedy happened within the walls.
For example, the punishment for talking in 1888 was solitary confinement for 6 days.
They would be put in the hole or the dungeon, which was a dark cell with no light. They were chained up typically during the day. They would handcuff their hands about a foot above their head all day long. And then they would lay on a plank on the stone floor was how they would sleep. So pretty severe punishments, and some men were put in the hole repeatedly.
Prisons across the country enforced the silent system that was first developed in New York. Stillwater evolved over the years to allow talking at mealtimes and holidays, but the rule of silence continued until 1951. For those who could read, they could read all they wanted. And in 1887, Louis P. Schoonmaker convinced the warden to let him go sell the cell and raise money to start a newspaper. Louis was in and out of prison for forgery, and he previously started a prison paper in Wisconsin that didn't last a year. He collected $200 from 15 incarcerated people to start the Stillwater Prison Mirror. They announced it was the only printed sheet in existence, organized, published, edited, and sent forth to the world by prisoners. The Minnesota Correctional Facility Stillwater is scheduled to close in 2029. Department of Corrections staff are talking about moving the paper to another prison to keep its legacy alive. Because the Mirror is the nation's oldest prison newspaper that's still operating today.
This call is from a correction facility and is subject to monitoring and recording. Hello, my name is Ronald Greer. I was associate editor and sports editor for the Prison Mirror, the longest continuously printed news prison newspaper in America. I was an editor there from 2017 to 2020. But how much information would you like? I can ramble.
Ronald Greer is the pre-press technician at Moose Lake, where he's incarcerated for homicide. I asked him if he'd ever heard of Stillwater's rule about enforced silence.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. So one of the things that me and Jeff Young would do, we would always read back through all the old prison mirrors, like from the beginning, right? And that was one of the things that me and him recall seeing, like, man, they couldn't talk. Like, it was, like, almost illegal to talk. And I was like, well, that's what you call a hard time.
The prisoners used sign language and whispered whenever a guard's back was turned. But the silence system was oppressive. Prison Mirror writers said they felt like beasts in the field, their brains becoming so small they couldn't give a sensible reply when spoken to. Locked in a cell for hours each night, one man said he needed to read if he wished to keep sane.
I like to see that even they, 140 years ago, found a way to heal something in themselves by creating a paper and giving back to a community. And that's really what prison journalism is, or definitely the Prison Mirror.
The first two editions had a motto that stated, "God helps those who help themselves." That got a big laugh out of readers who said prisoners do help themselves to steal. So the next paper had a new motto, "It is never too late to mend." That's still on the cover of every edition.
The motto that came later is "never too late to mend." So obviously it's a prison newspaper. A crime was committed, the judicial process was carried out, and then a person like myself and all the other editors land themselves in prison, but then they find this outlet that somehow can help restore something in you, but also restores something in everybody else.
Three brothers invested a quarter of the money to start the paper. The younger brothers.
Cole and Jim and Bob Younger rode with the Jesse James gang, and they were notorious bank robbers and train robbers for about 10 years after the Civil War.
The James and Younger families grew up in Missouri, where they supported the Confederate side of the Civil War. The older brothers joined a group of guerrilla soldiers notorious for committing mass murder in the Union town of Lawrence, Kansas. After the war, they learned that a Union general they despised had a lot of money invested at a bank in Northfield.
And in 1876, they came to Northfield, Minnesota to try to rob the bank, and it didn't go well. Several townspeople were killed and some of the robbers too.
Faced with a possible sentence to hang, the Youngers pleaded guilty. They were sentenced to life in prison.
It was truly a media circus when they came here to Stillwater, and it was a big deal.
This song, Cole Younger, written by the famous outlaw Cole Younger, on the wall of his cell at Stillwater Prison, Minnesota. I am a noted vengeance man, Cole Younger is my name.
In 1876, these were celebrities.
My friends to shame for the robbing of the Northfield Bank, and the same I can never deny. For that deed, I'm a poor prisoner in the Stillwater jail I lie.
They were well loved by the prisoners, I think, and by the wardens alike. And so I imagine it was a certain amount of clout to be amongst this select group of men who were starting this newspaper.
This was not the country's first prison paper, but it captured attention because it was a grassroots effort by prisoners and not the warden. It wasn't quite as proper and sanitized as other prison papers funded by states on the East Coast. The Prison Mirror did have a few critics. The Minneapolis Tribune wrote that men in the penitentiary should not have the liberty to print scandalous criminal news. Nevertheless, within a year, annual $1 subscriptions came from nearly every state in the Union. The Prison Mirror covered all expenses. The incarcerated investors got their money back with interest, and they even had $150 in profits to give to the prison library.
Newspapers in this part of the country were kind of just getting their footing, and it was a big, big deal to have a newspaper in your community.
A typical four-page edition on May 13, 1909 featured short stories and reader letters. There were jokes, baseball scores. Page 3 contained local news. Old Butch is laid up with a hurt shoulder. Canaries were born in the prison last week. The librarian has a Saturday Evening Post. Anyone interested in a copy can notify cell 531 through the guard. One editor in 1926 encouraged any prisoner to submit a piece, stating, "Yes, we have the silent system here, but that doesn't prevent your talking with pens and pencils." They couldn't write about politics, but they exchanged papers with other newsrooms, and they could share national news.
They love a good story about a wrongfully convicted man being freed. Those always make the newspaper. And they also, in this day and age of, like, robber barons, people making all kinds of ridiculous money and breaking laws, this is not lost on them in here. They like to kind of point out, you know, we're in here for stealing $8. And meanwhile, these bigwig bankers and politicians are on the hook for thousands and millions of dollars and nothing happens to them.
The newspaper included advertising.
And that's in Stillwater, too. Oh, boy, we've got tailors.
Heidi pages through some of the ads.
Con Hames Clothing House, which is here in Stillwater. They have the largest stock and the latest styles. Stoves, tinware, dry goods, millinery house. That's a hat maker. Hardware, boots and shoes, groceries. They're advertising just about everything in this paper.
One ad in 1894 announced, "Prisoners break out with laughter when they read Watson's Illuminator." But that's not just a joke. People escaped all the time.
Literally breaking through the walls. Or like you could rip a bar off of something and use it to dig a hole in the wall. People would just like lift the gate off its hinges. I've heard of people digging underground, climbing over the wall, like having somebody come and throw a rope over the wall and climbing up over. There were many, many escapes in the early years.
Frank Landers was described as a smooth talker, serving 24 years for forgery. He gave $20 to start the prison mirror. The guards gave him an extra hour in the halls each night to educate younger prisoners and gather material for the paper. He was really planning the best way out. He convinced the prison barber, Oscar Carlin, to help him, even though Oscar only had a few months remaining in his sentence. On October 12, 1887, while others returned to their cells for the night, Frank and Oscar bent a bar in the barbershop window to get into the yard and then tore off a board from the exterior fence. Detectives recognized Frank in Chicago, but they thought the $100 reward for capture was too small. They let him go. Oscar was not so lucky. Tracing his letters, police found Oscar working at a barbershop in Chicago and returned him to prison. Women were also incarcerated at Stillwater until 1920. Azilda Beaudry wrote in the paper, "Here hangs before me in a little frame the picture of two dear children. They are mine, but where are they?" One after another, three of Azilda's children died while she was incarcerated. She wrote, "Is it possible for one to commit a crime so great that no amount of suffering will pay the penalty?" One Mirror columnist, John Carter, lost a farming job in Canada in 1904. He'd been trying to make his way to Minneapolis, and he stole a ride on a boxcar. The train crew discovered him and threw him off the train in Kitson County. He hadn't eaten anything for 36 hours. He broke into the station's cash drawer, and he was caught. For the crime of stealing $24, he was sentenced to 10 years in Stillwater. Carter learned to play the clarinet in the prison band. He taught other prisoners to read in night school. One 45-year-old man told him the reading lessons made it worth being incarcerated.
But it was his poetry that ultimately kind of got him out of here.
Carter wrote poetry in the Mirror that was republished in Harper's and Century magazine. He received job offers and calls for his pardon. He was released in 1910 on grounds that his sentence was excessive. When he got out, Carter wrote that Stillwater Prison was inconceivably foul, but he had only good things to say about the prison mirror. He said, "Few prisoners can write well, but they know things worth writing."
People have always been fascinated by prison. I think now there's a surge of people being interested in true crime. And really, that's not new. I think that people 100 years ago, 150 years ago, really were clamoring to know more about life in prison. And they still are, you know, it's like the kind of secret that nobody wants to talk about. Every place needs a prison, but it's kind of a hidden world. So I'm really thankful for the Prison Mirror and other things that give you an insight.
Department of Corrections, Moose Lake Correctional Facility. To accept this free call, press 0.
My name's Donovan Diego. I'm currently work as a tutor in the education department and received a bachelor's degree while I was in Stillwater.
Donovan participated in a research group while incarcerated for homicide. He researched the history of the Prison Mirror.
Along with this research cluster, I was going through a book. I believe the book is in the Minnesota Historical Society, but it had actual photos of like the living block units. And as I'm looking at the photo, I was able to identify the unit that we were looking at. And I'm like, I know that unit. I've spent years in that unit. It looks the exact same. That was a little eerie to me.
Donovan was struck by what he did not see in the Prison Mirror. For example, he knew there were Minnesota prison rebellions in the 70s, but he couldn't find anything about that in the paper.
Kind of made me think about like what the majority of the population felt when they were seeing those articles come out. And I was wondering if they kind of felt, you know, maybe a little cheated or betrayed by a lot of the writers by thinking that you guys aren't really writing about or capturing what's really going on in here.
There was a time when incarcerated people jokingly referred to the Prison Mirror as the Good News newspaper. Responding to this criticism in 1973, editor Norman Mastrian wrote that they were censored. Sometimes they had to trash articles that took a lot of work. He said they had little to gain from writing lurid details of disturbances inside prison. Plus, they wanted to put their best foot forward for everyone reading outside the walls. He said they must tread a thin line between being censored and being seen as pro-administration.
Our former editor had some issues, and he ran into a problem in the dining hall at Stillwater, and he got assaulted there for something. He made somebody angry, and so he decided it was kind of a forced retirement.
This is Robert Taliaferro.
Prisons aren't a place where you want to make people angry sometimes, you know, especially back then. You know, it was a safe place to a point, but Stillwater used to have a reputation.
Robert was next in line for the editor job. He always kept the maximum allowable 20 books in his cell, and he got every book he could find on journalism. He came up with his own approach to coverage.
First of all, we're not going to talk about why a person was in prison, number one. Number two, we're not going to advocate for anybody's cases. We're not lawyers. What we will do, however, if a guy sitting up there and he creates a bonsai tree and he gets a blue ribbon for it, we're going to put his face in there. Here's something that you could show to your mama or your kids. We are not the monsters that the mainstream media wants you to believe. We're just human beings who made mistakes. It was my job and my writers to tell a story that here's what they're doing while they're incarcerated.
Robert's paper covered incarcerated cooks who made hot pot burritos on Super Bowl Sunday. In the style of USA Today, he ran prisoner portraits alongside their takes on national issues. He closely monitored the finances at the prison canteen, which was taking in millions from prisoners each year. One of his writers investigated a Department of Corrections contractor. They won a lot of prison newspaper awards. Robert expected excellence and no spelling mistakes.
My punishment was, if you have a misspelled word, after all of this stuff, we have dictionaries. You owe the office a six-pack. No beers, but oh, a six-pack of soda.
Robert's office had a fireproof safe containing the entire archive of the Prison Mirror. He'd look through it from time to time.
I was able to see over 100 years of history seen through the eyes of incarcerated men and women. What's the take of incarcerated folks when it came to World War I or World War II or the Korean War or the beginning of Vietnam?
In 1918, during World War I, prisoners collectively earned $75,000 in wages and donated $62,000 to the war effort. During World War II, they manufactured rope for the Army and Navy and donated blood to the Red Cross. In 1974, a prisoner joked that it was great to have Nixon, a crook, as president. He said, "It's about time one of us got the recognition he deserves." Robert oversaw the paper during the HIV/AIDS epidemic.
You know, at that particular time, especially in the early 80s, no one knew how HIV or AIDS was transmitted. You know, there was rumors about mosquitoes. There was all of these different things. We had one individual for sure that did have HIV and AIDS inside the facility. And so, you know, it was like, what do we do? I mean, even what they did at that particular time for that young man's safety, they segregated him. And unfortunately, he died. His family kind of disowned him and all that, and he died alone. And that was not a good time either, so.
Robert spent 38 years in prison. He was released in 2022. He remembers feeling uncertain if he would ever see the outside.
Maybe I will die in prison. I don't know. But I'm not going to die yet. I'm not going to die mentally in prison. And, you know, some people do that. You see, when there are guys where I would look in their eyes and I'd see they're just blank. There was no life there. They were done. That was it. That was it for them. They didn't care. They quit. And I said, well, I'm not going to quit.
I first started there, I think the very first day, I walk around, I'm looking at this guy's desk area.
This is Martin Hawthorne, who started working at Stillwater Prison in 2005.
He's creating a board game, and it's how to survive in prison. And it was like the game of life, right? And the very first square, I'll never forget this, it looked at, if you roll a one or spin a one, like in the game of life, first block says, up, new to prison, got to fight for your life, go to SAG, go back to start.
Martin provided vocational training in computers for 20 years. He thought it was important to educate people who'd been inside for decades, while technology evolved quickly outside.
When my buddies now used to talk to me about that stuff, I'd say, you know, it's like 94% of all convicted felons get released. So do you want to have, and this goes back to the warden in 1887, do you want to have somebody just sat for 8-9 years in a little 6x8 cage, did nothing but get more mad, or do you want to get them to figure out what they got going on in their life and give them the tools, put them in their little society toolbox to function in society? I'd rather do that.
Martin could teach Photoshop and design, and he ended up supervising the Mirror for more than a decade until the fall of 2025. Prison Mirror editors make $1.50 per hour. That's a relatively high wage for the prison system, where pay starts at 25 cents an hour. Whenever a newspaper job opened up, Martin vetted 3 or 4 applicants. He checked math and reading levels and gave them a sample writing assignment, and he checked their prison discipline record to be assured they could stay in the office for several months of training.
Everybody's got to know how to do everything. We can't just have a sports guy know how to do something and all of a sudden he gets beaten up or something, you know, he's gone. And they could be transferred at any time too.
Editors do the job without access to the internet, but they can ask their supervisor or their family to look something up online.
A lot of the stuff would be us reaching out to family and friends over the phone and then us taking longhand notes, dying notes, coming up, typing it in. And we have the tool to put the paper together, second to none.
Yeah.
But the information available to us, oh, yeah, almost non-existent. You know what I'm saying? It's like, something wrong with this picture. Yeah.
This is Carlos Sessions, a current Prison Mirror associate editor who's incarcerated for homicide. He said editors can access the Star Tribune. They can mail letters through the postal service. They can make phone calls that disconnect after 15 minutes. They have an email system called JPay, although contact must be initiated by someone on the outside, and it costs 40 cents to send a message. And they can interview people inside the prison. Carlos said he's noticed in the past that being part of the paper can open doors for guys.
I mean, I remember seeing them on the yard damn near. Whenever they had the yard open, they were out there. Someone from the paper was out there. The same with the gymnasium rec. wherever, you know, you can see guys going, you don't live over here, you live in another unit. So they did have access.
The newspaper covers all kinds of prison programming, like graduations, treatment programs, cultural meals and sports, all happening inside the prison.
I covered all sport events, ping pong, chess, handball, soccer, football, softball, basketball, 3-on-3, 5-on-5, volleyball.
This is Ronald Greer, the pre-press technician you heard at the beginning of the story. One of his favorite articles covered a softball team from the prison's mental health program.
Usually, they participate in sports. They go defeated throughout the entire season. They never win a game. Just watching the game, I sat there and I was like, I don't believe this. Like, oh, they have the lead. I was like, oh, they still have the lead. And then they won. But it was like they did not know they won, because why I really like this article is because they didn't go out to say, I won, we did this. They went out to just play. And that's why it was so important, because the outcome didn't matter, right?
You have 1 minute remaining.
That was great. And that was one of my more joyous articles to write.
I asked Ronald how he thought about criminal history during his interviews.
I try not to ever know why they're in prison. I only care about the person sitting in front of me. Who are you right now at this very exact moment? Obviously, you're in prison. Something happened, right? I don't want to know the heinousness of the crime, or if you were, or if the judicial system was correct in passing out punishment or justice, have say. I only care about the person in front of me right now and how are you presenting yourself. That's also one of the reasons I only wanted to be the sports editor at first. I was like, I don't have to dig into anybody's life. I can just see what you're doing on the field, and that's it. I get this, you know, this very superficial image of a person, of most your sportsmanship and your physical attributes and your skill inside of sport. But, you know, the more you write, the more you want to write different stories. So I began writing other stories just about the actual individuals instead of what they did in the game.
Ronald worked at the paper with Linnell Martin, a former senior editor who's earned 3 college degrees while incarcerated for homicide. Linnell said the writing was the most intimidating part of the job.
I was terrified about that part because I'm a slow reader. Reading and writing just wasn't my thing. Poetry, cool. I was good with poetry because it's like short form, you know. For me, it was just freestyling. Growing up as a kid in the hip hop culture, you know, like you grow up freestyling and busting rhymes and you know what I mean? So poetry was a natural form of expression for me.
When I toured the prison, I ran into Linnell in the hallway.
Is that Linnell? Linnell, I'm Michelle. Brooke.
Hey, nice to meet you. Yeah.
So Linnell joined me for the tour.
The masonry, the brickwork and everything, it's the same as the University of Minnesota. Mankato, Duluth, everywhere. And in Minneapolis, the same architect built this prison around the same time. So it's really actually a beautiful place.
Linnell works as a mentor in the prison. When I saw him, he'd recently been counseling an incarcerated man whose mom had just died.
Lost his mom. Yeah. I don't know if you heard. Yeah.
Yesterday.
So, yesterday, but the day before, he came, you know, and confided in me. And, you know, I sat there with him. Some of the work that we're doing in here, this is a really great, I mean, it's really transformative. There's a lot of different, we have people in here with levels of autism. Mental health is a huge issue.
So tell me about the stories that you were going to show me that you...
Yeah, so one of them, again, like, they really capture, they'll give you, like, a contrast to, like, what we were up against and, like, why this whole transformation is so important. One of the things was the violence in here.
In 2018, a correctional officer was killed by an incarcerated man who'd spent nearly 1,700 days in solitary for offenses inside prison. In the months following, corrections officers talked to the media about severe staffing shortages, and increasing assaults on staff.
I was doing a series of stories on the staff assaults because the staff assaults were being promoted in the media like we were just animals, and there were deeper issues going on with that. And people weren't just lashing out because they didn't know how to. That would be like the last resort. And so I interviewed the guys that had staff assaults on their records.
They told him what happened in the moments before they assaulted corrections officers. Traumatic news they'd just received from home, for example, and how they felt disrespected.
It was our opportunity to kind of like give another side of the story, and so a lot of guys were feeling like they were being demonized when it was really that, again, deeper issues. The biggest thing that reduces violence is just a conversation. Communication is, you don't need a whole bunch of weapons if you didn't even talk to somebody. You know, and a lot of the actual assaults and the inner fights and stuff are always, usually it's something somebody said. You know, or being like just being demeaned and belittled.
Linnell keyed into this idea for another series of stories highlighting all the diversity within the walls. He saw it as a chance to reduce miscommunication, which was often a source of conflict. He'd pick a phrase like, "Hi, how you doing?" and translate it into Hmong, Spanish, Arabic, Somali, and Ojibwe.
I mean, just imagine if you got locked up in China and you don't speak Chinese, right? And everybody around, like, you're not from that culture, there's cultural norms, and you have to survive in there for years.
Linnell is still writing another story. He's been working on it for years.
You got generations of the same family alive at the same time in prison. I'm in here with several of my own family members at the same time, and I'm not the only one. So many people from our community. And I think about the cumulative impact of that and how that is just devastating. I started doing interviewing family members, like father and sons that were locked up at the same time, cousins, brothers.
Linnell worked at the prison mirror alongside his cousin, Jeffrey Young. Jeff is incarcerated for homicide, and he's one of the first people in the country to attend law school from prison. He worked as associate editor of the Prison Mirror from 2017 to 22.
Compared to other Minnesota Department of Corrections, I'd give Stillwater an A on giving us the freedom to write stories. That's a relative grade.
Jeff interviewed the prison's plumbing supervisor about water that tasted like metal and looked like Coca-Cola, leaving black flakes in the sink. The supervisor assured readers the water was safe to drink. Jeff interviewed a man who attempted suicide in prison. He listed ideas for prevention and support. Jeff covered an accident at a welding worksite in 2018. Jeremiah Loeb was assembling docks when his shirt caught fire. Antonio Roebuck extinguished the fire by patting it out with his gloved hands. Jeremiah told the Mirror he'd never received safety training. The newspaper staff believed their coverage made an impact. Incarcerated workers received new safety gear, and they started signing documents confirming their training, according to the paper. Martin Hawthorne, the former supervisor, welcomes media coverage of prison.
It shouldn't exist as a black hole out there in Bayport. You know, it's a huge building, everybody knows what it is, but nobody knows what goes on inside it.
He said he always told the guys that the Mirror was not his newspaper, and it wasn't the warden's newspaper.
It's your newspaper. You can write about whatever you want, I don't care, as long as it's true. If it's true, I'll go to bat for you. At one point, there was they did an article about an offender, they call them IPs now, who got beaten up by staff. And so they looked into it and did all kind of research, stuff like that, and they wrote about it, and I had several guards come up yelling at me about that, and I'm going like, well, no, that's true.
Martin said editors couldn't write everything they wanted about incidents that happened in prison. Administrators might say there's more to the story, but they couldn't comment while incidents were under investigation. Here's Jeff.
I had a story censored that discussed, so there was a young man who stole a prison transport vehicle. Yeah, I think it was from Lionel Lakes. and there was still prisoners on the handcuffed and on the bus when he had stole it and took it on a big high-speed chase. And so I used that opportunity to discuss that when prisoners are transported and they're handcuffed, there is across the nation a lot of prisoners that are killed in accidents, and in part because of the way that they're, you know, handcuffed and shackled. And, you know, if they have no way to brace themselves in an accident, or if a prison van is speeding and hitting curves, they're just kind of flying around in a bus. They didn't want that one published.
Jeff did publish a general story about safety of prisoners transported without wearing seatbelts. Department of Corrections policy states that the newspaper must be published free of censorship, except when it threatens security or hurts rehabilitative efforts. Editors can't publish anything sexually explicit, libelous, or defamatory. Warden Bill Bolin is one of several staff members who read every edition before print.
For example, any type of gang affiliation, hand gesturing, even the crossword puzzle. Is there something that is being relayed in a crossword puzzle that could be a breach for safety and security?
Since he's been warden in 2023, Bolin said he's mostly dealt with issues like wording, grammar, or people throwing gang signs in photos.
When I get the final edition of it, it's not like if there's something that stands out, rubber stamp denied. It's more like, okay, I'm going to call Mr. Rissman.
J.T. Rissman is the current supervisor of the paper.
Have a conversation, if that warrants a conversation with the editors, to kind of get some more information. How is it that you can maybe share this message in a different way?
When I picked up the paper, I thought, okay, this is just going to be the voice of the administration.
Tim O'Mara previously worked at the Gold Rush Chronicle while incarcerated for criminal sexual conduct. He's one of the new associate editors at the Stillwater paper.
But then more and more, I started to notice that guys were kind of getting in some thoughts of their own on the paper and stuff. And I think some prison newspapers have been far more lenient on letting, you know, the guys speak for themselves rather than the administration.
Almost all of Minnesota's prison papers are not currently operating, including The Reflector at Shakopee Women's Prison, The Focal Point at Moose Lake, Lino Ledger at Lino Lakes, Gold Rush Chronicle at Rush City, The Reformatory Pillar at St. Cloud, and The New Perspective at Oak Park Heights.
When I was at Rush City, we got shut down for a few years. They came in one day and said, budget cuts, buddy, you gotta go. And so I got reassigned. But now the Gold Rush Chronicle, which is the same publication that Tom worked with and just left not too long ago, that's up and running. And
now they just shut it down.
Yeah. Oh, did they? Yeah. Okay, yeah. I didn't know that.
For decades, the Prison Mirror boasted that it used no taxpayer dollars. Funding sources included subscriptions and a cut of the fees that the prison charged to make phone calls. Now phone calls are free, and that large revenue source is gone. The paper is part of the general fund. But Warden Bolin says he's confident the paper will continue and relocate to another prison when Stillwater closes. He said discussions are underway.
It's a legacy, and I don't want to be the one that disrupts the legacy with that. And I don't think in a department that anyone really wants to do that.
Prison newspapers are much less common than they once were. Throughout the country's history, more than 700 prison papers launched in every state. Today, there's about 37 left.
They're everywhere. You know, now they're nowhere.
James McGrath Morris is the author of the book Jailhouse Journalism. He said there are a few simple explanations for the decline of prison papers since the 1980s.
We flooded the prisons with inmates for drug convictions. Every prison was under severe crowded conditions. They just simply wanted to keep the inmates locked down and under control. They weren't going to have a group of them go to the print shop and work on the prison paper. Secondly, it challenged the authority of the wardens everywhere to have this kind of publication. It's the last thing they wanted to deal with at this time.
California courts have ruled that the First Amendment does not stop at the prison gate, according to James. But even when courts favored prison newspapers, administrators could censor them in other ways.
You need paper? Oh, gee, the shipment of paper hasn't come in. Ink? Well, that'll have to be a special order. We'll have to wait 6 months for it. So administratively, they basically killed all the papers, and that trend went all the way across the country.
James says there's another reason prison newspapers are rare today.
Every day, a newsroom across the country is closing down. And that's the same thing for prisons. And the inmates, many of them probably didn't read a newspaper before they came to prison. The newspaper itself is faded in importance.
What? They're not as relevant? I love newspapers. I love to read. The tactile, and you turn the page. I have a subscription to the Star Tribune. It's information. Information is power. Information keeps you connected.
This is Michael Hall. While incarcerated at Stillwater for homicide, he earned a degree from Metro State. He's seen months-long delays in the prison mirror's publishing, like during the COVID pandemic, when everyone was locked down for long periods of time and all work stopped.
I think where it was most like palpable is like when the new edition finally showed up. Like, just everybody has a copy. Everybody's walking around. They're sitting in groups. They're walking around in twos and threes, and they're looking through the newest edition and talking about the article or the pictures that they covered from whatever event happened. We don't get as much news access. A lot of people don't necessarily get the newspaper here, so I know when they see a newspaper, they like to read it, but like just the prison newspaper, it covers a lot of things, so it's relevant. It matters. It matters. Newspapers matter.
Prison papers have also made an impact outside the walls. Articles in the Louisiana State Penitentiary's Angolite led the state to ban the electric chair in 1990. The podcast Ear Hustle out of San Quentin Prison was a Pulitzer finalist in 2020. Several writers published novels they wrote while incarcerated at Stillwater. For example, Frank Ellie's book, The Riot, became a movie in 1969, starring Jim Brown and Gene Hackman. Robert Taliaferro, the former editor you heard earlier, is part of an advisory committee that's relaunching the American Penal Press Awards. In the last contest, he read The Tiebreakers.
And I was like, wow, the quality of journalism that comes out of facilities now smokes anything. We had some good journalism, and I'm glad I don't have to compete with those guys now, and men and women. I would not be surprised if you see a Pulitzer Prize coming out of a prison.
Another writing contest was launched in 2024 by the Prison Journalism Project and the Society for Professional Journalists. They called it the Stillwater Awards. Here's Warden Bill Bowen.
If you're publishing a quality newspaper, right, that's award-winning, why would anyone in their right mind entertain dissolving it? When phase closure comes in 2029 for Stillwater, the prison mirror goes by the wayside. That, to me, that just doesn't make sense.
The Stillwater prison is scheduled to close in mid-2029 at the direction of the governor and legislative leaders. A study is underway to help decide what to do with the enormous site of more than 100 acres and more than 50 buildings. Legislative leaders say the prison must close because the infrastructure is crumbling. Spending $180 million on deferred maintenance would throw good money after bad, according to one government report. In the run-up to closure, hundreds of people have been transferred out of Stillwater. The prison went from incarcerating 1,180 people down to about 500 in early 2026. About 90 of those are part of a drug treatment program, and another 115 are housed in solitary confinement. And the rest are experimenting with a drastically different model of incarceration. Prisoners can apply to live in special earned living units that come with huge privileges. 860 incarcerated people applied for 310 spots. Everyone gets their own cell, with the chance to have a second cell to use as an office or a studio. Linnell Martin said it feels like an open campus. He said the changes would blow your mind.
Like, for instance, the phone I'm sitting on right now, I'm sitting in a chair that actually has a cushion on it. Typically, this would be a steel stool. All the old people call them hemorrhoid makers.
And they're adding color. People are painting their cells.
Last night, a few other guys who are currently at the prison mirror, and one of the older guys here, he's been locked up for like over 30 years. His name is Ancient. We call him Ancient. He just had his 70th birthday like 2 weeks ago. But anyways, he came to me and asked me if I would do a mural of the younger brothers. So I'm going to be doing a mural in like all likelihood of the younger brothers on the wall that leads to the prison mirror offices.
Four new editors started working at the prison mirror in the fall of 2025. Joining Carlos Sessions and Tim O'Mara are Associate Editor Brian Aker, incarcerated for criminal sexual conduct, and Senior Editor Thomas Incantalupo, incarcerated for criminal sexual conduct. I visited the Prison Mirror office and asked the editors how they thought about the younger brothers, including their violent history. Here's Tim, followed by Brian, with the others chiming in.
They did do their time, and I don't know what more you could ask for any prisoner. You know, if they did their time, they made some positive changes in their lives. They didn't cause any.
Well, they created something.
Yeah,
I mean, they did something
constructive,
and with that's what that we're asking for us. Everybody's asking us to do.
Right.
You know, to be rehabilitated.
How do we give 139 years?
Yeah. How do we give back to the victims that we have hurt in being constructive in what we're doing? I mean, that's.
And that was kind of what I meant before. Like, we all have, you know, something. Like, I know in my past, I've hurt people. You know, and that's just the way it is. I can't do anything about that. But I would hope that people would give me that second chance, at least to give me an opportunity to do something. And I have. I feel like I have that right here by having this position right Absolutely. Now that, you know, that I can, like, you know, like that positivity that we talked about.
The editors have the paper back up and running after a 9-month delay throughout Stillwater's staff changes and prisoner transfers. In their first January 2026 issue, Stillwater's transformation was the big story. There's a Q&A with the warden and a spotlight on an artist who painted Mario and Luigi bursting through a cell block wall. A second spotlight featured Sergeant Paul, who created a new barbershop in the rec area. News briefs include the death of Stephen Washington, who was killed by his cellmate at Rush City in late 2025. Another brief featured Brian Pippett, who's always maintained his innocence and received an extremely rare commutation of his sentence. As always, artwork by incarcerated artists covers the back page. Here's Brian, followed by Tim and Thomas.
I really enjoy hearing people's stories.
Yeah.
I want to know what their values are, what their beliefs are, and, like, I want to learn that. I want to understand that, and I want to see that in action, kind of thing. And that's something I do through my interviews as well.
And I want to archive it. I do, because, you know, 111 years from today, 131 years today, you know,
he does.
These people are going to be looking back, and we're going to say, Tim O'Mara, who was an editor back, you know, then, you know, had this to say, and he found it inspirational, just like I found Mr. Schumacher's little piece. We're going to try to do our best, and that's all we can do,
and
right?
They still didn't have flying cars.
And they still don't have flying cars. I want to put that on the record. Yeah.
Here's Linnell Martin.
Many people before us have overcome adversity and accomplished great things, and you know, everyone in here can do the same thing.
You have 1 minute remaining.
Keep me posted on, like, what's going on, or, like, if there's anything else I can, you know, any other questions. I hope at the end of the day it's something that may inspire people or garner more support from community to transform the way a lot of things how we approach,
Thank you for using GTL.
This is Michelle Brook for KFAI.
You've been listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. Special thanks to everyone who shared their voice for this story. Additional thanks to J.T. Rissman, Lieutenant Marks, Ferguson, Aaron Swanham, Shannon Lurkey, Patrick Bonga, Tracy Williams-Dillard, the Minnesota Prison Writing Workshop, Stillwater Public Library, and the Minnesota Historical Society. Support for Mini Culture is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Mini Culture tab on kfai.org.
Programming on KFAI comes in part from First Avenue, presenting Casket Cassette at the 7th Street Entry, Thursday, August 13th.
Dark wave post-punkers Casket Cassette storm the 7th Street Entry stage with their signature sound of brooding synth goth.
They're touring with their latest release, Reducer, an album that breathes with the air of life temporarily stranded between departures.
Casket Cassette wraps their music in the old, rotted hope that someone might reach into the wreckage and switch the current back on. Opening the show is Stranger Gallery and Stairway.
More information about Casket Cassette at the 7th Street entry is available at first-avenue.com.
Support for KFAI comes from the Dakota, presenting Ben Sidran, Monday, August 17th. Jazz pianist, singer, songwriter, author, producer, and music journalist, Ben Sidran returns to the Dakota stage with Billy Peterson on bass, Leo Sidran on drums, and special guest Ricky Peterson on organ. He'll be performing his signature blend of swing, groove, and freeform philosophy. Always infused with humor and hipster wisdom, Ben Sidran shows why he's the first ever existential jazz poet. More information about Ben Sidran at the Dakota is available at dakotacooks.com.
This is 10,000 Fresh Voices, a program of miniculture on KFAI. Did you know that there are more than 300 public library branches in Minnesota? It takes a lot of people power to keep things running smoothly. Many of these libraries are supported by avid book lovers who volunteer as part of their library's friends group. KFAI producer R. May Rivard caught up with a group of retirees in Brainerd dedicated to the support of their local library.
Nearly every library I've been to has a book sale or two during the year. The proceeds from these sales help support all kinds of things at the library. I'm fairly certain these sales are staffed and run by people who love books, and these volunteers are the worker bees behind every successful sale. As a person who loves to read and support my favorite libraries by perusing any sale I find out about, I was curious about how all this worked. Well, I got a peek behind the curtain with the Friends of the Brainerd Public Library as they sorted and sniffed their way through loads of donated books in the receiving area behind the storefront located in the Westgate Mall up in Brainerd. Meet Judy Reardon.
I live in rural Brainerd. I became involved with Friends of the Brainerd Public Library probably 25 years ago. One of the gals that I worked with volunteered with them, and it sounded interesting. So I began volunteering at their sales.
I had recently retired, and I wanted to do something with my time. I don't like to sew like I used to do. I don't know how to crochet, knit. So I just decided my love is reading books. I got involved, joined a book club with the Friends, and then found out about this book sale.
That's Karen Johnson, the current president of the Friends of the Brainerd Public Library.
My name is Mary Kalinowski, and I live in the Brainerd-Baxter area. I've been up here about 45 years. I'm a retired RN, worked mostly in the clinics, and I've been retired for about 10 years. So working as a friend of the Brainerd Public Library is one of my volunteer jobs, and the one that I like more than anything else that I do.
This is a group of people that gather every single Tuesday, and we sort through the books. And there are a ton of books that we get that are donated primarily by community members.
My task is when the books come in, we open each box at a time and check the books over. So every book gets handled at least once. We check the cover, make sure it's in good condition. We sniff all our books. We're all good sniffers here. We want our books to smell good. We page through them, fan through them to make sure there's no leftover paperwork in the books that people use for bookmarks. So we occasionally find a letter or store receipts or bookmarks, that kind of thing. We have found money, and several hundred dollars once in cash, and we were able to track the source and give the gentleman his money back. We sort our books and put them in these tubs, and then we move the books from the tubs out into the main part of the store in the correct category.
Judy Reardon, and we would put the books out in preparation for the sale, and then during the sale we would take stacks of books from people and take them up to the checkout table so they wouldn't have to lug all those books around with them.
We are located in the Westgate Mall. The mall has been extremely generous to us, giving us space for probably about 10 years. And for the last 5 or so years, we have been located in the same spot, which allowed us to set up as though we were having a book sale. And when we would sort the books, we would just put them out on the tables. And that has really been a lifesaver, saves a lot of time.
Sounds like a workout.
It is. Tuesday is our donation day. So we are here from 9 to 3, and they bring them to the service door of the store that we're located in at the Westgate Mall. About 97% of our books are donated from the public, and the other 3% are ones that the library has cleaned out. We have two pallets end-to-end in our service area in the back. It is not uncommon for those pallets to be empty on a Tuesday morning and be completely filled with boxes of books by the time we leave at 3 o'clock.
Most libraries have a Friends of Fill in the Blank Public Library that really do this. They walk alongside their library and say, how can we help you? What can we do? With that money that we raise, it all goes back into our library for what we call kind of the icing on the cake. We don't determine what we should buy. We look to the librarian, and our librarian looks to the staff and says, what do we need? The Friends group wants to donate. What can we use? So our overall goal is to truly support our library with whatever needs they have, and then also support that love of reading.
The dedication of these gals was impressive. It was more work than I would have ever thought went into sorting books. And now I know who to ask to recommend the next Minnesota author for me to read.
Thanks for listening. Support for Meeting Culture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Meeting Culture tab on kfai.org.
Sufficient fun, y'all get to that.
Can you?